So last time, during our interaction at the end of the talk, some of you suggested that it would be good if I deal with the topic of the attributes of a man of steady wisdom. It is in the Gita you find, those of you who are familiar with the text, you find sthita prajna lakshanani, it means the characteristics of a man of steady wisdom, who has reached a steadiness of wisdom, who is established in steady wisdom through the practice of meditation. So that's the topic we are going to deal with today. This comes in the second chapter of the Gita. Now, the second chapter deals with, rather it begins with a very interesting statement from Krishna in response to some of the questions that he put to the Lord in the first chapter. Arjuna said at the beginning in this first chapter, well, I cannot work, I'm terribly confused, perplexed, I'm in a great dilemma, I'm facing a great crisis in my life, please help me. Then he pleads to the Lord to teach him how to go about his duties and responsibilities in this world. Now, in response to that, Krishna makes a very interesting statement in the second chapter, before he starts his discussion on the characteristics of a man of steady wisdom. He says, the sloka is this, Dehi nosmin yatha dehi kaumaram yavanam jara tatha dehantara praptihi dhirastatrana muhyadi. The meaning is this, a wise man never worries about the past and present. A wise man who has established in steady wisdom through the practice of meditation has got a very calm and tranquil outlook towards the world, towards himself, and towards life as a whole. In fact, one interesting and one important characteristic of man, a wise man, is that he won't be agitated when he has to face a crisis, and he won't be overjoyed when something very pleasant happens to him. If a man is overjoyed if something pleasant happens to him, and if he's too much worried if something unpleasant happens to him, you should know that he is somewhat immature. He has no steadiness of wisdom. So here Krishna says, and in fact he is projecting a great philosophical truth here. He says, this body comes and goes. In Vedantic tradition, the human personality is conceived as a soul or self or consciousness which resides in a body. It is not a psychophysical mechanism. The psychophysical mechanism is only a vehicle, an instrument through which this divine consciousness expresses itself. Just as this this mechanism is necessary for electricity to manifest as light energy. If some other mechanism is there, then electricity will manifest in some other form. So this body and mind, intellect, senses, they all constitute one mechanism, just a vehicle or a medium through which that consciousness, which is technically called in Vedantic tradition as Atman, A-T-M-A-N, or Brahman as such. This Atman or consciousness is eternal. It never comes, therefore it never goes. because it has never come, because it was always there, so it cannot come. And because it has not come, it cannot go. It is not created, so it cannot be destroyed. So it doesn't undergo through the process of existence, growth, evolution, and decay. Because it is unborn, it is deathless. But what about this body? This body comes and goes. So he says, in this body, which goes through the process, this is called Shatvikara in Sanskrit. It means six changes, six levels of six stages of evolution. It comes into existence sometime in the past, which we call births. This body is born, it is created, just as this timepiece is created, or this glass is created, so also this body is created. And if something is created, then it should exist for some time. Of course, unlike these things, human body grows, and it evolves, and it decays, and it gets destroyed. So Krishna here says, Kaumaram Yavanam Jara, means boyhood, youth, and old age. But we can include birth, and also babyhood, childhood, youth, middle age, old age, all you can include. So all these different stages take place at the bodily level. But when you consider yourself to be Atman, the immortal consciousness, then you are beyond all this. Now, he says, dhiraha means somebody who has got steady wisdom. An enlightened man who has realized that it is not just this body or mind which is not eternal, but is the Atman or consciousness or self, which is unborn and therefore deathless, and it is beyond all changes. So those who think that they are the bodies, they will face death. And those who think they are just Atman or consciousness, which is embodied in this psychophysical mechanism, they remain steady in wisdom. In fact, in one of the old devotional scriptures, it deals with Sri Krishna's life and his activities. There is a very interesting verse. That verse gives a glimpse into the personality of the teacher of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna himself. It says that Krishna never wept, never cried, never doubted, never paused, never worried, and was never jubilant over joy. Because he could see into the past, the present, and future of everything. Normal human beings generally look at the present and also look at the future. It's just like seeing the iceberg, or what is visible of the iceberg above the sea level. But enlightened persons like Buddha and others, they can see not only the iceberg, not only that portion of the iceberg which is visible above the water level, they can also see the iceberg which is below the water level. So they can look at the entire human personality and also existence at all the three dimensions, the past, present, and future, because Atman is timeless. It is eternity. It doesn't exist in time. It is beyond time. Now, Sri Krishna says that a man of steady wisdom who understands that the line of demarcation between the present and the past is like a line that you draw on water surface, which is just an imaginary line. And therefore, when they look at things, they look at its wholeness, completeness, and they never worry, they are never overjoyed, and they are never grief-stricken, they never doubt. In fact, that is the sign of a man of steady wisdom. Now, after that, Lord Krishna gives a long exposition of that Supreme Consciousness, the Atman. He says this Atman is never born and it never dies. And after a long discourse, Arjuna puts a question to Krishna. Now you have given a long discourse on the philosophical aspects of this consciousness. Now tell me about the personality of a man who has reached this level of spiritual enlightenment. In Sanskrit, in the text is called Sthita Prajna, means somebody, the mean enlightened man, whose wisdom, whose mind is established in perfect equanimity, steadiness, and in wisdom. That is Arjuna's question. In answer to Arjuna's question, Lord Krishna begins a long exposition of the characteristics of a man of steady wisdom. The question is put in the 54th verse. Sthita prajnasya ka bhasha samadhisthasya keshava sthitadhikim prabhashida kim asida vrajedakim. This is the Sanskrit verse. The meaning is this. Please tell me, how does a man of steady wisdom interact with the world? And what is his outlook on life? How does he look upon the world? And how does he look upon himself? And how do we understand that he has reached that status of man of steady wisdom? He is fully established in the steadiness of wisdom. And in answer to this question, Lord Krishna gives a list of the attributes of how a man of steady wisdom is never worried. He looks at the world as eternal present. That can be one way. Because so far as he is concerned, the differentiation between the past and present and between the present and future is non-existent. There is no differentiation. Because he identifies himself with the eternal consciousness. And that consciousness is beyond the three dimensions of time. Therefore, such a man looks at the entire world as non-different from himself. And as he goes deeper and deeper through meditation and introspection, he realizes the presence of the immanent Supreme Consciousness within. And in direct proportion to this inward journey, this introspective process, he becomes and more universal, broad-minded personality. His outlook towards the outside world, towards the rest of creation, becomes broader and more universal as he moves deeper and deeper towards his own inner reality. This is just a synopsis. I shall just take a few verses and then I shall try to explain. Now, in answer to this question, the first sloka, that is 55th sloka, which gives a list of the characteristics of man of steady wisdom, says prajahadi yada kaman sarvan partha manogadan atmanne vatmana tushtaha sthita prajnas tadochide. Now he says one important characteristic of this man of steady wisdom is he completely gives up all selfish desires. That's one thing. So sarvan kaman prajahadi means he completely gives up all selfish desires. And then, of course, this is with regard to his approach or attitude towards others. And what about himself? Then he says, Atmani eva atmana tushtaha. He is satisfied with himself. This is the technical term. The idea is this. He realizes what a man, what everyone should strive to realize. The supreme spiritual enlightenment. He realizes that he is the Atman. And that Atman is omnipresent, omniscient, immanent, and transcendent. And the word used is tushta, it means contentment. Here, you know, contentment is defined in Indian philosophical tradition as a mental attitude which naturally comes to you when you feel that you have acquired something beyond which there is nothing to be aimed at, nothing to be sought after. This can happen only when you realize a level of spiritual enlightenment. All other gains, all other achievements will only make you work harder for more and more of those achievements. If a man who becomes rich, he works hard to be richer. If a man who gets a high position or a status, he works hard to acquire higher status. Everything in this world, prosperity, wealth, health, or reputation, all these, they may give you a kind of satisfaction. But that satisfaction is momentary. When a rich man finds that his neighbor is richer than him, he wants to catch up with him. Every man of reputation will try to catch up with somebody who has got a higher reputation. Every big bureaucrat will try to get an increment and to a higher promotion. So this gives you satisfaction, but that satisfaction only momentary. It is joy, but that joy is not complete in itself. That joy is accompanied by sorrow. Well, you have got a reputation, you have got a big position, but when you somebody who has got a higher position, that joy of having acquired that status becomes sorrow, means grief. Because it becomes dissatisfaction. So every feeling of satisfaction is accompanied by a feeling of dissatisfaction. Before you got that satisfaction, you were in grief. When you get it, you feel, well, I've gained something. But again, when you find that there is still more to go, still more to be acquired, that can be achieved, then you become dissatisfied. So that's why in another verse, Lord Krishna speaks of real satisfaction, which he calls santosha, means contentment. Contentment. Contentment is a mental attitude which comes to a man who feels that he has really achieved something beyond which there is nothing to be achieved. It is not not just one side of the coin. Every satisfaction, every feeling of joy is one side of the coin. The other coin is grief. Every experience of satisfaction is one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is dissatisfaction. After some time, you get dissatisfied. But there comes a stage when you get something, an inner spiritual enlightenment, when you feel, well, I have got something, there is nothing beyond which I can strive for. That attitude is a very important sign of a man of steady wisdom. It's called Atmaneva Atmana Tushtaha. He realizes that he is that Atman, and when he realizes that identity with the Supreme Consciousness, which is Atman, he feels, well, there is nothing more to go, nothing more to be gained. it is completely free from all kinds of grief, dissatisfaction, etc. In this context, in the 6th chapter, Lord Krishna says how a man of meditation reaches that stage. Sukham atyantikam yadvat buddhigrahim atindriyam. He says, atyantikam sukham means supreme satisfaction, which is contentment, which is spoken of here, which is referred to here. It is, and it is beyond the comprehension or perception of intellect, senses, or body. That contentment, that supreme contentment, cannot be achieved by any amount of effort at the sensory level or at the bodily level. So it is, Krishna calls it atyantikam sukha, means supreme. Sukha is Sanskrit word for joy, happiness. But then when atyantikam is an adjective, when he said it means supreme joy. And that's a supreme joy which naturally comes to a sage or a saint. Because that joy is not the result of any achievement at a sensory or bodily level. There is a famous story which comes in Eusebius writings. You know, Eusebius was a Greek traveler who followed Alexander the Great during his invasion. When Alexander invaded the western borders of India, today's Afghanistan mostly, and some parts. Alexander conquered Persia and moved further east. And then it is said, Eusebius writes in his travelogues, that he met a sage. Alexander happened to meet a sage. Alexander sent some of his soldiers to invite the sage to his camp. And the sage said, well, I am perfectly happy here, I have nothing to gain. And he was lying on floor under burning sun, you know. But there was a great supreme joy and happiness about him. There was no wealth, no house, nothing. So Alexander had heard of this great sage. So it is said that he wanted to meet him. And then the sage didn't go. Then Alexander himself went to him. And this comes in Eusebius' dialogues. So now what kind of joy, what kind of contentment was it that gave him the courage to tell Alexander, if you want to meet me, you come here. It is the supreme contentment, you know. Because when Alexander said, the Eusebius goes further, what gave you so much of courage? Because I am the emperor. Alexander had come all the way from Macedonia, and then after conquering Persia, Bactria, had come right up to India's western borders. And then of course he went back. And then he said, well, you kill me, that's the greatest joke I ever heard, because I am this body, and this body will go away, if not today, tomorrow. You can never kill me, because I am something other than this body, which you are talking about. And it is said that Alexander honored that great sage. Now, this is a very interesting, very, very well celebrated event recorded in Eusebius' travelogues, which describes Alexander's adventures in the East. So, Lord Krishna says, this supreme contentment is one important sign of a man of steady wisdom. And this is achieved through a kind of meditative process. When you travel inward, as you draw in yourself inward, you realize that you are the supreme consciousness. But then along with that, your outlook and attitude towards the rest of the world also changes. You also realize that immanent supreme consciousness which is within you is not only immanent, it is also omnipresent, it is all pervading. So in Vedantic tradition, there is no distinction between creator and creation. This is a very important principle, and this is what distinguishes Vedantic concept of God from other monotheistic concepts of God. In Vedantic tradition, God is not only the efficient cause of the universe is also the material cause of the universe. The Creator Himself is present in the creation. So Creator and creation are one. So as a man progresses in spiritual life, he becomes a better and better human being. He becomes more broad-minded, more universal in his outlook. All the rigidity and all the narrow-mindedness go away. And another important distinction is, in Vedantic tradition, as I said, God is not an extraterrestrial entity, as I said. He doesn't create the world and stand apart from it. The Creator and creation are the same, and therefore the Creator is present in every living being of the creation. The creation itself is a manifestation of Creator. This is the, of course, this I will, as we go on more and more, we'll understand. So from the pantheistic concept of God, as I mean, where you know you equate nature with God, Vedanta takes you to the highest idea of God, where God is present as a divine spirit in every being in this world. There is nothing in which the divine spirit is not present. This is one aspect. So when this Chitta Prajna, the man of steady wisdom, realizes that he is the immanent supreme consciousness within, residing within, he also realizes that same supreme consciousness is present everywhere in this world. So it is a kind of spiritual democracy, spiritual unity. He becomes identified with the entire creation. So such a man goes beyond all kinds of narrow-mindedness, rigidity and on. So he is able to look upon the grief, sorrows and also pleasures of the whole world as his own. In fact, in the sixth chapter that we are dealing with, Lord Krishna says, it is this characteristic which distinguishes a yogi from other human beings. And a yogi is another name for a man of steady wisdom that we are discussing here. Atmupam mena sarvatra samam pasyati yorjuna sukham va yadiva dukham sa yogi paramo mada. Lord Krishna says in this Sanskrit verse, which is translated in English, he is the yogi. That's my opinion. In my opinion, he is a real yogi. Who is the yogi? That yogi sees other people's pleasure as his pleasure, and other people's grief as his own grief. This is the kind of identity. That's why Atmanneva Atmana Tushtaha. So on the one hand, he achieves a supreme level of contentment, perfect contentment. He feels there is nothing more to be gained, nothing more to be sought after. I have achieved the supreme spiritual accomplishment, and there is nothing beyond this that I can strive for. So it gives you a kind of supreme contentment. But it doesn't make you inactive in this world. This is another important point. You find in some of the ancient works, you find long descriptions of such men of steady wisdom being active, working active in this world, working for the good of others. But the only difference is they won't be worried and they won't be overjoyed. So far as action is concerned, so far as behavior is concerned, they remain active. But within them they realize that the entire creation is one spiritual entity. This is the first characteristic of a man of steady wisdom. Such a man is Siddha Prajna, means a man of steady wisdom. So the word is used, Tushta means perfectly contented. satisfied. He doesn't go after anything. Not that he becomes completely inactive. He will continue working for the good of the world, but he will not be stricken by grief, and he will not be attached towards anything which gives him momentary enjoyment or pleasure. Now, the great commentator who lived in the 8th century, his name was Shankaracharya, many of you must be familiar. He is the one who actually made this book, the world classic that it is today. It is said that if Shankaracharya had not written this comment, his commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, the Bhagavad Gita would not have become a world classic. Because many of you perhaps know, many of you may not, there are 18 different Gitas in ancient Indian mythological, philosophical and historical literature. 18. And of a Gita means songs, hymns, poetical works, poetry. And this work became such a masterpiece, such a world classic, because of the masterly touch of the great commentator who lived in the 8th century, in Shankaracharya. He makes a very interesting remark, and that is very important. He says, the Lord Krishna is giving here a list of the characteristics of a man of steady wisdom who have reached this spiritual consciousness, this identity with spiritual consciousness through meditation. So these are the characteristics of a man who is well established in meditation. Every spiritual aspirant should try, work hard to acquire these characteristics. This is a very important remark which Shankaracharya makes. These are the natural characteristics of a man of steady wisdom. What we are discussing here and what we are going to discuss in future are the natural characteristics of a man who has established himself in steady wisdom. But what about a spiritual aspirant, a beginner, a spiritual seeker? So he says every spiritual seeker should strive to acquire these characteristics. So a man living in this world, he can work in this world, he can be active, he can acquire wealth, material prosperity, he can make use of science and technology, but you should keep in mind that these won't give me eternal peace and happiness. That's all. There is something beyond this which alone can give me eternal peace, permanent peace and happiness, and that is spiritual enlightenment. If one can acquire, one can gain this spiritual enlightenment, it will give you supreme contentment. Other things are necessary. They are only tools for life in this world. We should not be caught in this, in our struggle for material prosperity, material acquirements. Work for them. But at the same time, every spiritual aspirant should try his best to acquire these characteristics. See, what are the characteristics of a strong man? You may say, heavy muscles and, well, so many other which you know better than me, perhaps, you know. Now, so what are the characteristics of world global wrestling champion? You may give a long list. Now, what should a normal man do? He should try to acquire muscles like that or body shape like that. Then he himself becomes strong. Similarly, if a man tries hard to acquire these characteristics, which we are going to discuss in the other verses, he can very easily and gradually get established in spiritual wisdom. So that's the 55th verse. In the 56th verse, Lord Krishna says that this man of steady wisdom is not easily shaken by any adversity that we already hinted in the first verse. And he doesn't go after happiness and joy. And he is free from all kinds of attachment, fear and anger. And he is a sage, he is a man of steady wisdom. Dukheshu anudigna manaha, sukheshu vigadaspraha, vidaraga bhayakrotha, sthidadhihi, munihi ucchede. This is the Sanskrit verse. So the idea of going beyond pain, that's the subject here. One can go beyond pain only by avoiding going after pleasure. That is the central message of this. Because if you go after pleasure, you become a plaything, a slave of natural forces. But if you can go beyond anything which gives you pleasure, you can avoid pain. It doesn't mean that man should not seek joy or happiness. That's not the meaning here. One should not think that it is possible to have a permanent state of happiness and joy in this empirical material world. That's all. Because very often people become grief-stricken when they have to face a crisis, because they think a crisis something we should never happen in our life. We should have a permanent state of enjoyment and happiness. This is absolutely impossible. So when we realize, or if we realize that it is not possible to have a permanent state of joy and happiness by acquiring empirical material tools of pleasure, if we realize that it is not possible to acquire, to have a permanent state of happiness at the material level, we won't be grief-stricken if unhappiness or grief or unpleasant or something unpleasant happens in our life. Because a problem is a problem when you think that there will be no problem. If you know that this is part of the game of human life, then it is no more a problem. It becomes a creative crisis. It's an experience that we know we have to go beyond. See, you feel even a small problem appears to be a very big dilemma or a crisis, because we think that this crisis or dilemma or unpleasant event should never happen. We are seeking a world in which there will be always joy and pleasure and happiness. And so we become attached to that. And then we expect always to have a very pleasant life. Life should be a bed of roses. So if something else that we don't want, if something happens, but we become grief-stricken, it appears to be a very big dilemma and problem. But if at the philosophical level we realize that life is a coin which has got both sides, two sides, one side is pain, the other side is pleasure. You can't have a coin with only one side. If we understand this, we will be non-attached. We will not be attached too much. We will be obsessed with, we will not be obsessed with pleasure. So that dukkeshu anudikta manaha. That means your mind will not be shaken by any adverse or unfortunate event in life. In fact, esthita prajna, a man of steady wisdom, realizes that life can never be always a matter of happiness and joy. You can never have perpetual happiness at the empirical, the phenomenal level. It is impossible. Once you realize this and live in this world, then an adversity cannot shock you. You may have to face an adversity. You may have to face problems. But once you understand that problems are an inevitable part of this game of human life, problems will not be a very big, unsurmountable dilemma or crisis. You will be mentally ready for it. So this gives you a kind of equanimity of mind, a kind of serenity, and a psychological efficiency to face problems in life. So this man of steady wisdom is not at all shaken by any adverse events in life. And again, but this is possible only if he is completely free from any hankering for happiness. If a man is looking for happiness always in life, then naturally he will have to face unhappiness, he will be shaken by adversities. So only by being non-attached or through dispassion towards pleasure and happiness, one can go beyond pain and grief. That is the idea. In fact, this wisdom, this attitude becomes natural for a man of steady wisdom, for somebody who is well established in steady wisdom. But this is something which every spiritual aspirant should try to cultivate by reading good books, by associating with people who will discuss these subjects, and also by trying to keep in mind the supreme truth that empirical comforts, physical comforts may be necessary, but there is something beyond this that we must strive for, and that is spiritual enlightenment. So this is for the seeker. And now Vitaraga Bhaya Krodha, it's very clear, means he should be completely free from attachment. Attachment here, you know, it means obsession, being obsessed with material comforts, sensory pleasures. That's the meaning here. He should be completely free from any kind of obsession, any kind of passionate attachment towards material comforts. He can have them, but he should not be a slave of material comforts. And he should be free from fear, because a man of steady wisdom realizes that world is one, humanity is one spiritual family. So he doesn't have to fear anybody, because he doesn't see anybody as different from him. Because all kinds of fear are due to seeing another man as different from ours. That is a Vedantic dictum. If you can look upon the entire human family as one spiritual entity, there is no need of fear. So fear doesn't become the criterion for morality in spiritual life. In fact, that is the that's one important characteristic of a man of spiritual wisdom. And I already quoted once, you remember, Swami Vivekananda once said, the infinite oneness of the eternal soul is the sanction, the only sanction of all morality, all ethics, and all good actions in this world. The highest criterion of morality is our identity with the entire human world, with the human family. It is not fear of God, rather the realization that God is present in every living being in this world. So nobody is alien to us, nobody is different from us, nobody is our enemy, nobody is a foreigner, or nobody is a stranger. Everyone belongs to one single spiritual family. So this attitude becomes natural, a natural characteristic of a man of steady wisdom. This is possible only through meditation, because in meditative practice we first try to think over the transitoriness of external world, external things, and then we try to meditate on the Supreme Consciousness, which is the immanent indweller in all living being. And then we realize that this immanent reality is also the omnipresent Supreme Consciousness, all-pervading, everywhere. So that gives a feeling of perfect identity with the entire human family. So this becomes a natural characteristic of a man of steady wisdom. So we have to give proper discipline and education to human emotions and human feelings. One should try to understand that at empirical level, one can never have perfect happiness and contentment. Perfect happiness and contentment can be achieved only when we realize identity with the entire human family. This is the gist of the 56th verse. When we discuss the subject later at the time of interaction, during interaction, we can discuss more. Now, 57th verse says, here, the same idea is emphasized further. Yes, sarvatra anabhisneha tattat prapi shubha shubham na abhinandati na dveshti tasya prajna pradishthita. The idea is this. He is completely unattached. He is neither pleased or grief-stricken. Before explaining this verse, I have to refer to another important verse which comes here in the second verse, where Lord Krishna gives a graphic description of how a man gets attached to the world, how he becomes obsessed with the material comforts and become a slave of worldliness. In the following verses, he will say that I shall quote the verse, then I shall explain, if I give a detailed description. These two stanzas, Dhyayato Vishayan Pumsaha, Sangasteshu Vajayade, Sangha Sanjayade Kamaha, Kama Krodho Vijayade, Krodhat Bhavadi Sammoha, Sammoha Smriti Vibhramaha, Smriti Bhramsha Buddhinasu, Buddhinasa Pranasyadi. Two stanzas where the Lord gives a graphic description of how we get caught, we get trapped in this world of senses, and how one can get out of it. So that those two verses are very relevant before going further. The Lord says, see, when we go on thinking about worldly pleasures, our mind naturally develops a kind of deep obsession and attachment towards those things. See, if our mind is not already obsessed with desire, worldly pleasures cannot have any impact on our mind. When our mind is always dwelling on worldly enjoyments, sensory enjoyments, and at the same time, if we see something outside or hear something outside or through any of the five senses, we come in contact with any of these sensory objects, our mind and the sensory objects, they establish a link. And then mind naturally develops a desire for the sensory enjoyment. So if a Ramana Maharshi sits in the marketplace or he sees advertisements or anything, he won't feel much bothered about those things, because his mind is not dwelling on those objects. If a man of steady wisdom is exposed to all kinds of sensory enjoyments, there will be no link, there will be no connection between them, because the sensory worlds belong to one wavelength and this mind is at another wavelength. There will be no interconnecting link. If a man of supreme wisdom is surrounded by tempting worldly pleasures, it won't have any effect on him. But on the other hand, an ordinary man, here man means human being, any individual who normally thinks that worldly pleasures can give him peace of mind, joy, everything, and then if he is surrounded by those things, naturally his mind and these sensory objects establish a link, and then he develops a desire for those things. and then he directs his energies and efforts towards acquiring those desired objects. And we often, this effort may not always succeed. If he fails in this object to acquire them, what happens? Either he becomes depressed, or it creates a kind of aversion or anger in his mind. And then what happens? When he becomes angry, his mind gets upset. This one. So first, he has already establish his mind. There is already so much of desire for enjoyment in his mind. His mind is full of desires. And then he is surrounded by external objects, sensory objects, desirable objects, and he develops a desire for them. And then he starts directing all his energy and efforts towards acquiring those objects. And that may lead to depression or anger. And when anger comes, he loses his mental balance. And then what happens? Gradually, when he loses his mental balance, he becomes a slave of the world. Now, this never occurs to a man of steady wisdom. But he realizes that these things are part of the world, but they cannot give eternal peace and happiness. And he is the Supreme Consciousness, which is beyond all this, the eternal reality. Now, once he gets himself established in this, when he understands the nature of external objects, he can remain unattached towards everything in this world. So, yes, sarvatra anabhisneha. Who is unattached everywhere. He can live in this world, but need not be worldly. So one can live in this world without being worldly minded. Remain in this world, but need not be worldly. Sri Ramakrishna is the teacher of Swami Vivekananda, gives a supreme example in his teachings. He says, now if you are traveling, if you are trying to cross a river in a ferry, if the water enters the boat will capsize. The boat should remain on the surface of the water. If one can avoid water from entering the boat, one can safely cross the river or ocean, whatever may be. So similarly, one can live in this world, but if he remembers that these sensory objects are not the supreme goal of human life, they may be necessary, but they are only transitory entities, then he can remain unattached, free from all attachment. And then he says, Subhas, and then he may not be pleased when something good happens, and he may not be depressed when something unpleasant happens. Such a man is established in wisdom. This again becomes a natural characteristic of a man of steady wisdom. And this is something which everyone should try to acquire. So, this question may arise, how do we control our senses while living in this world? As I said last time, when we talk about controlling our senses, what we mean is, we are diverting the senses towards a higher goal. Your senses can never be forcibly withdrawn from their respective objects. It's a natural characteristic of every sense, every one of these senses, to flow towards external objects. And these senses will drag mind also towards external objects. That's what establishes the connecting link between objects of desire and also mind. Mind is drawn towards sensory objects by ears, by eyes, by touch, by taste, by all the senses. Simultaneously, every minute, every moment, mind is being dragged towards external objects. So, what one should do? One should try to divert these senses towards creative, desirable objects. So, instead of reading undesirable things, one can read good things. Because reading feeds the mind with creative ideas, good ideas. So, mind will dwell only on those ideas. Mind will contemplate on the creative ideas. Ideas which are helpful in spiritual life. Otherwise, conflicts will come. If we want to lead spiritual life, and if we don't consciously try to feed our mind with spiritually nourishing ideas, then there will be a lot of conflicts. What happens is, mind is trying to acquire spiritual wisdom, but senses are bringing bad food to the mind. So mind becomes unhealthy. So conflict starts. So, by diverting the senses towards objects which are helpful in spiritual life, we will be able to feed our mind with healthy food, spiritually nourishing food. Then conflicts will cease. That's why he says, such a man can look at external world, look at different types of experiences with a sense of equanimity. This is stated in another context also, in the second chapter, Yogastha Kuru Karmani Sangam Tiktva Dhananjaya Siddhya Siddhyo Samo Bhutva Samattam Yoga Uchyate. Yoga is defined in this verse, in a very graphic style. So, a perfect equanimity of mind towards gain and loss is the psychological description of yoga that is mentioned here. What is the psychological description of yoga? Yoga, he means meditative process for acquiring steadiness in wisdom. That is what is meant by the word yoga here. So, a real yogi, a man of steady wisdom, will have an equanimity of mind. So, siddhi means gaining all that we strive for. Asiddhi means not getting any result. So, whether we get positive result or negative result, one should keep our mind in perfect equilibrium, in a state of equanimity. This is the psychological description of yoga in the Gita. And Lord Krishna says, this becomes the natural characteristic of a man of steady wisdom. Now we will have meditation for 25-30 minutes. After that, you can discuss this subject. And I must tell you at this stage, perhaps, you know, for many of you, at least some of you who are not familiar with the text, many of these ideas may be new. But you are free to put any question related to this subject. This is an open session. You can, there may be many ideas which may not be already clear to you. I may have used some Sanskrit terms which may be quite unfamiliar to many of you. So you can request for a repetition or description or translation of those words. I'd be only too happy to give you a more elaborate description of those points. So at 8:30 we will begin the interaction session. Now we have meditation till 8:30. Om, peace, peace, peace. If there is any subject for discussion.
I'd like you to explain, because of your depth of your understanding of Sanskrit.
Sanskrit?
I like to because of your level of understanding of Sanskrit, I'd like you to explain to the people here the word
Sanskrit.
Explain to them the word
Sanskara,
what the word Sanskara means.
Samskara.
Yes,
oh, yes, yes. Now, Samskara stands for impressions, residual impressions of our actions, thoughts and words that we perform in our life. Well, I can just I shall give an example. Samskaras got different meanings, you know. Samskara can mean culture, it can mean sacrament and so on. But in the present context, samskara means the residual impressions of our actions. I shall give an example. Well, suppose you are walking in the street, you come across different objects. Now, all that you see and identify yourself, see, this is a post which I have seen yesterday. This memory is possible because of samskaras. If you have seen this post 10 days earlier, and then if you are able to identify the post as an object that you saw 10 days back, it's because that act of seeing leaves an impression in your chittam. It's called chittam. Chittam is the repository of memories and impressions in mind. This samskara can work in two ways. If the experience is pleasant, it can tempt you to repeat that action which produced the samskara. If the experience is unpleasant, it can make you run away from that action, from repeating that action. Samskara means the residual impressions that get accumulated in mind. Our psychomechanism is divided into four compartments in Vedantic tradition. Four compartments. One is mind itself. When you see an object from a distance in semi-darkness, you are not sure whether that object is a pillar, a post or a human being. So you are not sure what it is. It is your mind which is operating at this time. And then when you go near it, when it becomes clear to you that it is the form of a human being, your intellect decides, determines it is a human being. Now, when you identify this human being as somebody whom you have seen earlier, your ego mechanism operates. It identifies that person as somebody whom you have seen earlier. But after 1 year, when you see the same person, if you are able to recognize him as the man whom you have seen a year earlier, it's because that memory remains, gets accumulated. It remains in your mechanism. That mechanism is called chittam, which accumulates impressions, memories and vrittis. If the experience is pleasant, this may perhaps discourage you from having a similar experience. If it is pleasant, it may tempt you to have the same experience. If it is unpleasant, it may dissuade you from having a similar experience. So samskara is nothing but residual impressions of past actions, not only physical actions. It could be words that you have spoken, it could be a thought in your mind. All these can leave an impression in your mind, the chittam. That is called samskara. But word samskara in Sanskrit, as I said, you know, it could mean sacrament. For example, marriage is a samskara, sacrament. Sacred thread ceremony, these are the samskara, is sacrament. So these are, there are 16 sacraments. These are all called samskaras. Samskara can also mean culture, civilization, refinement, and so on.
Given what you said about the nature of impressions and their memory, and in order to reach a state of perfect wisdom, you have to somehow dislodge the samskaras from your citta.
Yes. To attain perfect wisdom.
Correct.
Yes.
So, in other words, the process is using meditation. But essentially, what you're trying to do is take the samskara and free yourself from that.
Yes.
Well, I would like to know how you see the process of that taking place.
Yes. Now, these impressions, these samskaras, they operate only so long as you identify yourself as this physical human being. Because it is as a physical human being that you acquire these samskaras through various actions. The moment you reach a high level of spiritual enlightenment, where you cease to identify yourself as this physical human being and you start identifying yourself as Supreme Consciousness, then these samskaras completely vanish. Because these samskaras are acquired at the physical level and they are acquired with the help of mind, intellect, etc., and also the senses. And when you realize that you are not this body, you are not this mind, you are not these mechanisms which acquired these samskaras, you are the Supreme Consciousness which is beyond all this, all these chains get broken. These chains get completely broken the moment you realize that you are the Atman, you are the Supreme Consciousness. Now, how this is possible? Through meditation. That's the next part of the question. Through meditation, it doesn't happen all of a sudden. It takes some time. Through meditation, first we try to think of ourselves. What are we? What am I? Am I this body? Am I these senses which bring all these samskaras, impressions from external world? I am not that. I am the Supreme Consciousness. But this is not possible immediately. In the beginning, you have to make use of strong conviction by enriching your mind with positive thoughts and actions, by diverting your senses towards those ideas which will help you to reinforce the conviction that you are not this body, you are this consciousness. It takes a long time. And once you succeed in it, slowly the idea that you are this body goes away. When the idea that you are this body goes away, the idea that you are the senses which acquire the samskaras also goes away. And slowly, you know what happens? These samskaras cease to function. The samskaras can function, they do function only when you realize that you are this body. Because, see, I can give an example. Well, you have seen a particular object in the street. You are able to remember that event, that experience, only with the help of your body consciousness. I am the one who saw this object yesterday. And it is your eyes which brought this impression, this samskaras to your mind. And it was your body and your mind, your senses, which participated in a collective action in bringing the samskaras to your mind. But the moment you are fully convinced that you are not this body, you are not this senses, the samskaras also vanish. But this is possible only gradually by first purifying the mind. Purification of mind means filling it with positive ideas, emptying mind of all negative, unhealthy, undesirable ideas. Then mind becomes pure. Mind cannot stay idle, you know. Mind is always active. So first try to feed your mind with good, healthy ideas. That will reduce the conflicts, and when conflicts decrease gradually, you realize that I'm not this body, this mind, all this which are involved in all these activities. I'm the Supreme Consciousness. So that is why at that stage you feel that all these chains are broken. All this. So in the Upanishad, Munduka Upanishad, Vidyate Hriday Granthi Chidyante Sarva Samshayaha Shriyante Chasya Karmani Tasmin Tushte Paravare. The idea is this: when you get that to supreme experience, all these chains are broken. And remember, all doubts will vanish only when you get a little bit of experience. That is the speciality of spiritual life. Doubts will never vanish at the intellectual level, at the logical level, through argumentation. That's why Chidyante Sarva Samshaya, doubts will vanish. Doubts cease to exist only when we get a little experience, when we start the journey, when you take the first step towards active spiritual practice. So mind becomes more and more calm and quiet. And to that extent, doubts will vanish.
So Swami, we talked tonight about the man of steady wisdom in a negative sense, in that he does not want the ups and downs of life. So then we went to meditation, and then the question is, what am I meditating on? Where am I going? What is my object? How do I pursue that?
Yes. Now, when it comes to practical meditative life, those who have got an instruction from their teacher, respective teachers, they should follow that. But Gita gives some general outlines. Gita says, first we must divert our senses and mind towards positive, spiritually nourishing ideas and objects. And then, when mind is filled with these positive ideas, slowly it becomes calm and quiet. Those who believe in God can meditate on the supreme, on that God ideal at the focus of meditation. Those who do not believe in God can watch their breath. So that's meditative practices are possible even for agnostics. But for those who believe in a supreme idea of God as the indweller, the Vedantic concept of God is the indweller, we call Antaryami, the immanent reality which is present in all beings, the effulgent Jyoti, called the supreme light, which is consciousness, which is immanent reality, present in everything. If one can concentrate on that at the Hridaya Bhagamita, heart level, then slowly you find these senses and thoughts gradually get withdrawn from their objects and get focused on this ideal. This is the meditative practice. For those who believe in God, it is very simple. Those who believe in a spiritual ideal, because they can think of, while meditating, they can think of that spiritual ideal. They can try to concentrate on that. And slowly senses and mind get withdrawn. And if they meditate on that supreme deity as seated in one's own heart, as the embodiment of supreme effulgence, supreme consciousness, supreme knowledge and supreme bliss, then it becomes easy. That's the idea behind it.
Swamiji, can you give us an example of a man of wisdom?
Man of wisdom. Give an example. Well, I can give, of course, there have been many men of wisdom. If you read the life of Shankaracharya, Sri Ramakrishna, or Saint Francis of Assisi, Vivekananda,
are they avatars,
Tamana
Maharshi. Or do you consider them avatars? Or?
Well, not avatars. Oh, let us look at Mahatma Gandhi. It's a classic example. I think I mentioned once, you know. Now, see, Mahatma Gandhi, I mentioned this once, you know. When he passed away, and he was shot 3 times, it is said by those who were eyewitnesses that there was no fear, there was no shock, there was nothing in him. He was a great man who continues to inspire not only spiritual seekers but even those who are agnostics, you know. So it's a classic example of a man who reached the status of a man of supreme wisdom, steady wisdom, through the practice of selfless action. Mahatma Gandhi is a classic example.
Okay. So how about like Christ?
Yes, Christ is another example.
But
would you say they are on different levels? I don't think. Because Christ, you know, Christ also passed away asking for forgiveness to, you know, to those who were responsible for his crucifixion. You know, this is possible only for spiritual personalities who reach that supreme. See, the point is Vita Raga Bhaya Krodha. I mentioned here, you know, somebody who's beyond all anger, sense of revenge or fear or anything. You know, the supreme level is Christ. Christ is also a classic example.
You said it's impossible for us to be in a continual state of joy or contentment, but do you think that Ramakrishna or Buddha or Rama Maharshi were in that kind of state or continual peace? Or, and if not, then what is the enlightenment they were in? How would you describe that?
Well, they, you know, these great men, if you read their life, they also have to confront certain difficult situations which normally make people unhappy. But if you read their life, you find they must have reacted that way momentarily, but it never made them upset or unhappy. Though they reacted perhaps with some kind of anxiety to those unpleasant situations, they never lost their balance. They never lost their equilibrium. In fact, that is the basic difference. One of our scriptures compares the difference between an ordinary man and a man of steady wisdom, supreme, the one who has realized the supreme consciousness. So the example is given in some of our Sanskrit commentaries. See, you just compare how a king plays a violin in his own court for relaxation and hobby, and how a professional violinist who is asked by the king to play in his court. If he, in medieval times, you know, if a king invites a professional musician and he plays in the court, the musician will be very anxious to put up his best performance, because he may lose his life if he doesn't do well, or he can expect a reward. So he will be so much obsessed with his performance, he will be anxious. But the king plays on his violin in his own court when he is free, he won't be bothered by anything. So a man of supreme wisdom will live in this world. He may also work for the good of the world. He may also be engaged in normal activities, but he will be completely free from all anxieties. He can mentally act as a witness of his own life and his own events, his own experiences. Mentally he can stand apart as a spectator watching the play. He can watch his own life, his own activities with complete dispassion, non-attachment. But an ordinary man will not be able to do. He will be completely, he will be upset by any unpleasant event. That's the main difference. All great spiritual teachers had to face problems, but they were not upset by it.
So they just had a great degree of peace, and that was their enlightenment?
There are many great spiritual seekers, just aspirants, who have reached some level of mental tranquility. But you can't say that they are on the same level with Buddha or a Christ or like that, you know. That's all. But still, there are many people who, even in all walks of life, you can find people who have achieved a very high level of mental maturity and all that. But they may not be able to behave like a Gandhi or a Buddha. So a man of steady wisdom will be able to look at his own life and all the events related to his life as a spectator watching the drama going on in the stage, not as a actor but as a spectator. So he can remain non-attached, at the same time he can be active. That's the characteristic. That's why he's not touched by grief or sorrow or joy.
So what I understand you're saying is that these different levels of experience of steady wisdom are, the way I'm understanding it, are basically higher and higher levels of conviction, ending in realization that the highest level is to basically that there's no separation between you and anything else. It's all one. But that process is the process of that requires, as you said, time, and also I think it requires a certain union with that. Whatever you want to call it, chosen ideal, ishta, you have to have some form of love flowing between that and yourself in order to have the opportunity to make those changes.
Yes, for spiritual aspirants who have received their instruction from the teacher, there is no that they can follow that path. But the Gita gives the general philosophical outline.
In
fact, all the great teachers who instruct their disciples follow one way or other the ideas presented in this Gita. So, you know, in spiritual life there are two levels. You know, one, a seeker who wants to study the Gita, wants to become familiar with these ideas presented here and practice in their own life, in their own individual way. That's one approach. And there are those spiritual seekers who get their instruction from a teacher. For the latter group, they should follow the instructions of the teacher. But basically, this is the outline. As he said, when you withdraw your senses and mind from external things, you need a focus within. So if one can meditate on the ishta seated in his heart, it is very easy for him to withdraw, because he can think of the life of that supreme spiritual, the spiritual personality who is your ishta, chosen deity. He can think of different events related to his life, his instructions, his teachings. All day, directly or indirectly, will help you to withdraw the senses from external objects and gradually mind also. But when Gita expounds this idea, it is a very general exposition. I hope it's clear. So, Gita generally give some instructions for spiritual personalities.
Could you say something more about conflict, klesha, in terms of not only the physical, you know, the contradictions in life, but the psychological.
Yes.
Also,
you find when you try to meditate, or when you, even when you sit, try to sit quiet, when you try to, when you are lonely, when you are sitting quiet, you find conflicts arise in your mind. So many people are afraid of being alone. Lonely, to be able to enjoy loneliness is a sign of high spiritual wisdom. So in the Gita, there is a famous sloka, Aradhi Jana Samsadhi. In fact, one important necessity for great spiritual aspirants is they should learn to enjoy loneliness. Loneliness is not necessarily physical loneliness only. Even if you are sitting in a hermitage in the high mountains alone, you may be as good as living in a crowded marketplace if your mind is not rested. So one should be able to enjoy a state of being alone with oneself. Then you find, and if you are a beginner, you find suddenly there is always an ongoing conflict between your efforts to focus your mind on spiritual ideas and the conflicting ideas and memories arising in your mind because of innumerable impressions, samskaras, which your senses have already gathered from external objects and accumulated and dumped in your mind, you find. This is what happens, you know. So when you try to meditate, when you try to introspect, and you try to contemplate, these conflicts arise. The conflicts arise because there is a dichotomy, there is a disbalance, total conflict between what you are trying to contemplate on, what you are trying to meditate upon, and the memories and impressions that you have already accumulated in your mind. So how to reduce this conflict? By acquiring positive memories, positive samskaras, positive impressions from external world. External world will always work upon your mind. There is no doubt about it. Every beginner will have to confront this problem. Your eyes will bring undesirable visual memories. Your ears will bring undesirable audio memories, and so on. All the five senses and mind collaborate very well in helping you to accumulate undesirable memories and impressions. So, but we cannot withdraw them. One can withdraw only when you reach a higher level of spiritual evolution. At the beginning, what you should do, we must divert these senses towards positive channels. So instead of seeing undesirable visual objects, see desirable visual objects. Read good books. So, or associate with people who will help you in spiritual life, who will reinforce your spiritual ideas, who will enrich your own spiritual culture. You should try to avoid those who may give more conflicts to your mind, who will increase the conflicts in your mind. Because if there is dichotomy between your attempt to meditate or the object of your meditation and the already accumulated impressions in your mind, these conflicts will always arise. So to reduce the conflict, you have to bring your senses closer and closer towards spiritually useful and spiritually helpful ideas and impressions. That will reduce the negative impressions. If you bring in more and more positive impressions, that will reduce the strength of negative impressions which you already acquired. And gradually negative impressions become weak and positive impressions become stronger and stronger. And that will gradually help you to meditate more effectively, more easily. The conflicts will reduce. That's why one book that all of you can read is Swami Yadishwarandaji's Meditation and Spiritual Practice. That book is very helpful for those. He gives some practical things. All conflicts are due to the conflict between what we are trying to achieve and what we have unfortunately accumulated in our mind. This dichotomy is the main reason for most of the conflicts. So to try to bring your impressions closer and closer to the spiritual ideal which you are trying to achieve. Any?
So, Swami Bhante, you mentioned an edition of the Gita last time, Swami Ranganathananda's Gita.
Yes.
So I have brought a copy of Swami Ranganathananda's Gita,
yes,
in three volumes.
Yes.
And then the other Gita you mentioned from
Tapasyananda, yes,
the simple one volume Gita. If somebody is interested in them, I put them up there for people to look at, and I can bring more from the city if somebody is interested in them.
Yes. Yes, one is a three-volume set, Swami Ranganathananda. It is a very modern exposition, simple language. The other one is
Tapasyananda,
a single-volume work. Both have got the original and also translation. Swami Ranganathananda's book is much more elaborate in his presentation and approach. Those who want those books can have a look at.
From the same source, do you have access to Eknathiswaran passage meditation?
So probably it has some of
Eknathiswaran. Eknathiswaran, yes, it probably has. I think our books are in San Francisco.
I saw several books from him there when I was looking at the Gita. There were books on the Gita from him.
I think it might help people who don't know what to focus on, because the idea for passage meditation is that you find brief passages by mystics and you focus on that, memorize that, and it becomes a part of who you are. It adds more of the positive.
Yes. In fact, any sublime spiritual teaching from any religion or any great saint can be a point of focus. Any sublime spiritually stimulating teaching, words, sentences can be a focus of meditation. Somehow senses have to be brought away from external objects towards a higher object, so to speak. The object is subjective and internal, of course.
Are you going to have a focus next week on a particular chapter or concept?
Eh?
Are you going to have a focus next week on a particular chapter from the Gita or concept like this?
Oh, yeah.
Tonight you had the Man of Steady Wisdom in meditation.
This we have not completed. Maybe in 2-3 classes we'll complete this. In fact, there are 18 verses. There are 18 stanzas dealing with the attributes of a man of steady wisdom. We have dealt with only 3 of them. So we'll have plenty of time. Yes.
What does Bhagavad mean?
Eh? Bhagavan.
Yeah.
Bhagavad. Bhagavad Gita means. Gita means song. Bhagavad means the Lord. So a song sung by the Lord. That's what it means. By God means Lord. Bhagavan, the word itself, means the Supreme God, who is the embodiment of ultimate spiritual wisdom, spiritual renunciation, and all the great spiritual attributes. It's called Bhaga. That's different. So a song sung by the Lord, that's what it means.
Is it Advaita Vedanta?
No, Gita has been commented upon by the great Advaitic teacher Shankaracharya. and great Visishtadvaitic qualified non-dualistic teacher Ramanuja, and also Madhva, and several other commentators. So the most ancient commentary that is available today is Shankaracharya's commentary. It is Shankara's commentary which actually brought Gita into world focus. So Ramanuja and others wrote later commentaries. Other, Madhva came almost 350 years after Shankaracharya's passing away.
But he was a dualist.
He was a dualist, yes. Ramanuja was a Visishtadvaiti. It is Shankaracharya who expounded Advaita, which teaches that the Supreme Reality is immanent, transcendent, omnipresent, and in his high, as a man grows in spiritual life at the highest level, he realizes the Supreme Reality as an impersonal principle, not as a person, but as an impersonal Supreme Spirit, Supreme Principle. That is Advaita. Ramanuja taught that this world and all the living beings are part of God. God is whole, and the world and the individual souls are parts. And Madhva believed that God is different from all living beings, and God is different from the world, and world is different from all living beings, and each object in this world is different from each other object, and each living being is different from each other living being. It's called Panchabheda. Means Madhva was a total dualist. Shankaracharya was a total non-dualist. And Ramanuja stands in between these two. I think we have. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tatsat Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa.